This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Friday, November 22nd. I'm Eric Latch, writer and editor of The New Yorker's online news column, The Current, filling in for Dorothy Wickenden. This week, 10 of the 17 Democrats still running for president met on a debate stage in Atlanta. The setting was significant. Georgia has long been a Republican Party stronghold, while Atlanta was one of the epicenters of the civil rights movement. Last year, Stacey Abrams became the first black female nominee for governor in state history and very nearly won the office. Democrats are considering what it would mean if Georgia became a competitive state for them, and the party's presidential hopefuls are debating the best ways to talk to and for the black voters that make up a key segment of the Democratic Party's coalition. On the debate stage on Wednesday, Pete Buttigieg, who despite leading in polls in majority white Iowa and New Hampshire is currently polling at 0% with black voters in South Carolina, addressed how he hopes to connect with those voters.
While I do not have the experience of ever having been discriminated against because of the color of my skin, I do have the experience of sometimes feeling like a stranger in my own country, turning on the news and seeing my own rights come up for debate, and seeing my rights expanded by a coalition of people like me and people not at all like me, working side by side, shoulder to shoulder, making it possible for me to be standing here wearing this wedding ring in a way that couldn't have happened two elections ago, lets me know just how deep my obligation is to help those whose rights are on the line every day, even if they are nothing like me in their experience.
Jelani Cobb, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me from Atlanta to discuss the relationship between the Democratic candidates and African American voters, and how attempts at suppressing the black vote may affect the outcome of the 2020 election. Jelani, welcome.
Thank you.
So you've been in Atlanta this week, and you wrote a piece about the significance of the Democratic Party holding its debate in the city. Can you tell us a bit about what you made of that choice of venue and what you think went into it?
So it's a really atypical place to have a presidential debate. On a soundstage at a movie studio. So why this place?
Yeah.
And in order to understand why that choice made a particular kind of political sense, you have to know a little bit about what's been going on in Georgia for the past year. Obviously, there was this very controversial election last year. Lots of people, and you'll hear this among the Democratic candidates fairly frequently, lots of people echo the line that but for voter suppression, Stacey Abrams would be the governor of Georgia right now. Brian Kemp assumed the office of the governor and signed into effect a very, very stringent anti-abortion law, which generated a backlash nationally. The complexity for Georgia, however, is that in the past decade, particularly in the past decade, it has really exploded as an entertainment hub. So you have television shows being shot here. You have films being shot here.
Music production.
Music production. And so that made it vulnerable. Famously, Jordan Peele and J.J. Abrams said that they were considering pulling out of production of a show that they were going to be shooting in Georgia in protest of the anti-abortion law. And so in the midst of this, Stacey Abrams stepped in and kind of brokered relationships with people in the entertainment industry, saying that it's better for them to, quote, stay and fight. Those were the terms that she used. And having the debate on a soundstage at a movie studio in Atlanta with Tyler Perry, who is another figure who is also integral in telling the entertainment industry not to abandon Georgia, it was a kind of symbolic message that for people who were in Georgia who had seen the past year of events there made perfect sense to them.
So you're in town in the lead up to the debate and even some overhang afterwards. There's all kind of like satellite events that the presidential mm-hmm. candidates are going to. And you went to some of them. Can you just tell us a little bit about what you saw and what the mood was and what the conversations are like there?
So, I mean, it's, in essence, these candidates, most of them, they have either arrived early or have stayed late after the debate, and they fanned out. And if you were to kind of look at a Black history map of Atlanta, it's almost as if the candidates divvied up the map and picked a spot, you know, kind of Black heritage spot to go speak at. So Cory Booker and Pete Buttigieg and I believe it was Amy Klobuchar also went to Ebenezer Baptist Church, where Martin Luther King had once been a pastor, and they helped Stacey Abrams' phone bank, you know, calling people to let them know that they may have been purged from voter rolls and they would need to make sure that they were eligible to vote. Julian Castro, who did not even make the cut for the debate, but nonetheless came to Atlanta, had a event at Pascal's, which is a kind of legacy restaurant in the West End of Atlanta, also famously Martin Luther King's favorite soul food place. Pete Buttigieg spoke at Morehouse College on Monday, and that was a kind of interesting event in its own right on multiple levels. He received a polite reception, I would say. When I was talking with students afterward, he kind of played to mixed reviews, I guess would be the best way of framing it.
What did the students say to you?
Well, one student said that you know, one of the topics that he touched upon was the Supreme Court, saying that he thought that people should serve 18-year terms or people should rotate off the Supreme Court. And a student I spoke to said that he thought that sounded fine, well, and good, but he really shouldn't sell that as something that can be achieved during a presidential term or even likely in two presidential terms.
Yeah.
He kind of criticized him for what he thought was a pie in the sky kind of thing. One other student did raise something that I think is significant. The Buttigieg campaign rolled out something they're calling the Frederick Douglass Plan, which is really quite impressive and comprehensive. It looks at a number of different things relating to African Americans and inequality in the United States and has approaches to address them. But the rollout of it really just kind of was an unforced error. They got the support or potentially the support of 400 prominent African Americans in South Carolina. Then it turned out that not all 400 of these people were African American. Some of the people whose names were on this list said they didn't even know how their names got on there. Other people, embarrassingly, took pains to distinguish their support for this plan from their support for Pete Buttigieg as a candidate.
Yeah.
And so it is the best plan that you've ever seen so many African Americans move away from so quickly.
Yeah. So I want to widen the lens a little bit. The Democratic Party started this primary process with the most diverse presidential field in history. But now here we are 2 months or so before the first primary states start voting, and the top four candidates in the race are all white. At the top is Joe Biden, who in part has been able to achieve this position because he commands overwhelming support among African-American voters. How has he gotten that support? How has he drawn that level of support?
Some people have said this is about the legacy of Barack Obama. I think that may be part of it, but it'd be really wrong to overstate how much that plays into it. The thing that I think probably better explains his current standing among African Americans is that I think people are really looking at the primacy of defeating Donald Trump. It's been kind of a conventional wisdom that Joe Biden has the best chance of doing that. And so in South Carolina, if we kind of remember this, if we think back in history just a little bit, Barack Obama surged in South Carolina after he won in Iowa. African Americans liked him, but until Barack Obama proved that he could actually win and that he could win among lots of white people, he couldn't make the case for winning among African Americans. I think the same sort of thing is at play with Joe Biden. People have attributed it to brand loyalty. On the debate stage, Joe Biden said that this was a product of his long history with African Americans. I don't think that any of those things really explain it. I think that it's pure political pragmatism.
Even as Biden, you know, the worst moments of his campaign have come when he talks about race. I mean, here's a guy who was sort of wistful for the days when he was working with segregationists in the Senate. And, you know, just on the debate stage, I mean, there's this moment where he was touting his support among black voters. And yet in that moment, he says, you know, he's gotten the support of the only African-American woman that's ever been elected to the U.S. Senate, a reference to Carol Moseley Braun, and forces Kamala Harris, who's standing like 10 feet away from him, to put up her hand and be like, I am very much an African-American woman and very much a senator. And yet these moments have not hurt him. They've been kind of campaign scandals, gaffes in the media. And yet voters, it's not the thing that they talk about when they talk about Biden and his issues.
Right. I think the relevant metaphor here is the prisoner's dilemma. People are not necessarily thinking about what they want to do. They're thinking about what they think other people will do.
Yeah.
And so as long as it seems that he is the most reasonable figure to defeat Donald Trump, I think that he is not in jeopardy of losing black voters very significantly, barring some sort of catastrophic gaffe.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So I want to talk about Bernie Sanders here. One of the interesting stories that the polls tell is that while Biden's lead among African-American voters overall is huge, when you sort of start to get down into the numbers, young black voters don't support Biden the same way that older black voters do. There's a split by age among black voters, and many, many young voters support Sanders and other candidates, but Sanders in particular seems to be doing quite well there. And what do you make of that, and how has he reached those voters in particular?
Well, I mean, I think there's probably a lot wrapped up in that, but one of the things is that since the last time he ran, Bernie Sanders has really courted those voters. He's courted younger African Americans. When you look at his outreach people, he was primarily using surrogates who were maybe 35 and under. I think that's part of it. I also think that people are thinking about the things he's talked about, you know, in very practical terms, you know, like college affordability and the income gap and things that young people are really concerned about. So this is a diverse population, and people are, you know, thinking broadly about who it is they're familiar with, who they're interested in, and so on. Some of this is also a product of name recognition and visibility. Buttigieg and Warren are just not known quantities. Sanders is not a known quantity, but he did realize in 2016 that he had to begin making inroads with African Americans in the South. Really, if you're thinking seriously about pursuing the nomination, you really have to make a game plan to win those voters over.
In some ways, I think the strongest evidence for that read is that Harris and Cory Booker are also struggling to consolidate black support, in part because they're less well-known than Biden and Sanders.
Right. And I think that it's partly that they're less well-known. But Harris, the only thing I think that explains her lack of really being a top-tier candidate on the basis of that is that people have the same idea about pragmatism. People are concerned about whether or not white voters will go for her, whether or not she'll be the person that can defeat Donald Trump.
But we heard, I mean, Harris has made this argument, and we heard Booker at the debate make it explicitly, that they are in a position to reassemble the Obama coalition. And it occurred to me that in some ways, you know, there's also this debate about whether Democrats have to compete and win back the Midwest states that they lost to Trump in 2016, or whether, and this takes us back to sort of Georgia, they should be looking at Georgia, South Carolina, Texas. But it occurs to me that in some ways, the debate is the same one because they both involve turning on African-American voters. There's a very convincing argument that Wisconsin, Hillary Clinton lost Wisconsin because African-American voter turnout was down. You know, do you see winning the Midwest and winning the South as two different kind of paths for the party? Or what exactly are we arguing about here, I guess?
Well, I can tell you what's being said in Georgia about that.
Yeah.
The Democrats may not get those Midwestern states back. If you remember the kind of quaint old days when Hillary Clinton could refer to those Midwestern states as her firewall.
Right.
Now, Georgia has 16 electoral college votes. That's the same number as Michigan. And that is six more than Wisconsin. And it's only four less than Pennsylvania. And so they're saying, and when we're talking about those states, there's a part of it is like lower African-American turnout. But the conversation tends to be about winning back working-class white voters in those states.
Yeah.
And what they're saying in Georgia is that if you're not sure about those people, if you think that Donald Trump may still have some kind of Svengali-like hold over those voters, then maybe you should be thinking about the future in Georgia. Maybe you should be thinking about North Carolina. Maybe you should be thinking about Texas in the ways that these states can be the new path for people who are trying to get to 270 electoral votes.
So, you know, to take this back to Georgia and to Abrams, what is the situation on the ground that Democrats are going to find in 2020 in terms of access to the polls and getting people out and ensuring that they are able to get their votes counted? I mean, what are the challenges that Abrams specifically is involved with trying to navigate for the Democratic Party right now?
Well, what the landscape will look like in 2020 is anyone's guess. You have a governor who purged people as Secretary of State. Hundreds of thousands of voters were struck from the voting rolls. At the same time, one of the quieter things that's happened is that Brian Kemp has signed into law a bill that really made some significant changes in the way that elections are run in Georgia. So, for instance, you cannot change polling places within 60 days of an election. That was one of the big concerns that people had, that, you know, polling places were being moved around. It also takes longer now for people who choose not to vote for them to be removed from the voting rolls. The other thing that it does is strike down what they call the exact match policy, which meant if there was any deviation between your ID and your name on the voter roll, they would not let you vote. So that has been prohibited by the law, too. In theory, Democrats will be facing a more fair landscape in the next election as it pertains to Georgia. Whether or not that plays out in practice is anybody's guess.
Jelani, thanks.
Thanks.
Jelani Cobb is a staff writer at The New Yorker, a professor of journalism at Columbia University, and the author of The Substance of Hope, Barack Obama and the Paradox of Progress. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Eric Latch, filling in for Dorothy Wickenden.